James Steele is a two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and the author of America, What Went Wrong? And Empire, a biography of Howard Hughes. This is James Steele. I'm Duncan Gammy. You're listening to the Dunk Tank.
Thank you very much for joining me today.
Glad to be with you, Duncan.
So you've done a number of important books, and there are two that I wanted to talk to you about today in particular. One of them was the book Empire about Howard Hughes, and the other is America, What Went Wrong? And I think that by talking about Howard Hughes first, it might help to illuminate America, What Went Wrong? So if that's all right with you, I wanted to ask about Hughes, because you had told me that people have gone to you to consult about, you know, documentaries about the guy, movies. He holds such a mythic status still in the American consciousness. Why do we care about this guy so much?
I tell you, that's a great question, and I've tossed this around in my own mind for decades, needless to say. Both during the research and afterward, because it has been an enduring fascination with him. In fact, it's not just in this country. In the last couple of years, the foreign rights have been sold to the book to places that previously were not interested in, China and Turkey, of all. I guess maybe because you have maybe autocratic governments in both of those places. And Hughes appears to be a very authoritarian figure in many ways. I'm just speculating. But I think one of the enduring interests in Hughes is that he appears to be such an individual. You don't find anybody else quite like him. It's a mixture of, on one hand, some fairly impressive abilities, but on the other hand, some serious personality problems and obsessive behavior that very often nullified a lot of his own achievements. All of these things put him into a very, very unique class. And unlike a lot of people today who sort of carve out one area for themselves, whether it be in entertainment or industries or you name it, whatever, Hughes had his hand in about a half a dozen major fields during his lifetime. And that also separated him from a lot of other people. So, and then beyond that is just the personality, the human being himself starts out with a lot of promise, gradually begins undergoing some mental issues that worsen as he gets older, which make it more complicated and difficult for him to function the way most of us do, which is one of the reasons he sealed himself off for the last really 15 to 20 years of his life. So all of those things make for somebody who's like really one of a kind. We're always using that term, but Hughes really was one of a kind. And I think that in many ways is one of the great attractions, interests.
Yeah, you mentioned the mental problems, and that's obviously, he is kind of a romantic, tragic figure in a lot of senses. Even though he had this spectacular life, creating Hollywood movies, he was setting flight records, it doesn't seem like he was a very happy guy. I mean, do you think he was able to savor any of these accomplishments?
I think that's a very good observation. I think he was all in to achievement. Flight records, aviation records, making movies that were stunning, creating new kinds of industries. He was all into achievement. Much of this, I think, trying to at least equal his father's achievement, who invented the famous Hughes tool drill bit, revolutionized the oil industry, and was the whole basis of the family fortune. So a lot of those things, he was more interested in that, frankly, I think, than creating happiness for himself. He was a very, very lonely fellow who, for most of his life, felt he didn't need anybody else. The money would buy him the loyalties, the friends, put friends in quotes, would buy him whatever he needed, people to follow his will and his instructions. It was only late in life, when the mental problems worsened, and deteriorated when he really did need a true friend, somebody to say, Howard, we've got to get you some help here to stave off some of these demons that are in the process of trying to destroy you. But he didn't have that friend. And as a result of that, the end of his life was very tragic and not very happy. And frankly, he wasn't all that happy in the years before that either. And I think it stemmed really ultimately from just that sense of loneliness that he that sort of dogged him his whole life.
Do you think there's any truth to the idea that maybe his obsessiveness played, even though it played a part in his downfall, it played a part in his success as well? Because, I mean, I read, you know, you're talking about stories from his movie making days where he thinks that there's a fold in some actress's dress, and he's writing memos to the entire production staff about how they got to get rid of this fold. And it's,
yeah,
it's crazy obsessive behavior.
Right.
But clearly it produced results, no?
Yeah, it's a good observation on your part. Yes. The trick with Hughes was when the obsessiveness insisted on a certain kind of excellence. Let's just say, let's just go back a little bit in time when he took the round the world flight in 1938. It was a very, very famous event that captured world attention. And Hughes flew a Lockheed along with a crew of, I've forgotten the number right now, four or five other guys. They went all around the world, set a record, did something nobody had ever really done before. The obsessiveness in terms of building exactly the right plane to make that trip was a perfect example of where the obsessiveness had a very, very positive result. They created an extraordinary machine that had all the latest gizmos and gadgets in it, and it made it possible to do that revolutionary flight at the time. And then the other side of the obsessiveness is when he was under tremendous pressure, the obsessiveness would sometimes lead him to do the craziest kinds of things. When Hughes Aircraft Company was under great pressure from the Pentagon because it was fouling up some of its contracts, Hughes, rather than turning his attention to that, issued an order that he wanted a complete study of what all the candies and snacks were and all the company's vending machines. You know, totally crazy. Makes absolutely no sense. But that was kind of the way he did things. And then later in life, of course, just the obsessiveness about the fear of germs, fear of people touching him, was completely out of control. So you're right. It was a double-edged sword for him. It was able to produce perfection in some areas. But in others, it was the heart of his destruction.
Where do you think that obsessiveness came from?
Well, one of the most interesting things we did when we did the biography, we stumbled across a cache of letters in the Library of Congress. When you're researchers, when you're reporters, and you're doing work like this, you try to open every file you have time to look for. And so in the Library of Congress, there were a number of files where his name apparently appeared. And one of them was with a fellow who later went on to found the Boy Scouts. Well, it turned out that Daniel Beard, that was his fellow's name, had run a boys camp in the Northeast Pennsylvania back in the teens, 19-teens, when Howard was roughly around 8, 9, 10, 11, somewhere in that vicinity. And in this file of Beard's papers were all of these letters from Hughes's mother about to take care of Howard, make sure that he's not, if there's some boy in the camp who has a cough, make sure you isolate Howard from him. She had all kinds of queries about germs. Clearly, this had some effect on him. And it turned out his grandmother on his father's side also was very, very phobic about germs. So it seems to us there was some predisposition there, both in the chemistry of his mother and grandmother, but also in the environment around him. She was just petrified of that. And then on top of that, she died young, as did his father, a little over a year after his mother died. And he was an orphan at 18. So he knew how quickly death could come. And that I think that also affected his worry about illness and things of that sort.
And when he became a major recluse at the end of his life, was that just an extension of this long-standing personality trait, or was this something qualitatively different?
That's a good question, too. I started to say it's largely an extension. I mean, you can see him moving in that area when he's in his 40s, right after World War II, the late 1940s. He was died, by the way, in 1976, so he still had 30 years to live after that. But you can see him gradually starting to retreat from society a little more. So I think it's essentially an extension of where he was heading, but I don't think it was an inevitable extension. I think it was the fact that he got no assistance. And in fact, everybody around him did his bidding. If he was upset about germs, they played the game with him. And in fact, the aides around him actually wrote memos to each other about how to what Mr. Hughes wanted, if you were going to open a can of fruit, how you were to approach him if you walked into a room, if you were to hand him something, you had to make sure you had a tissue on the paper. All of these things, they catered to all of his wildest obsessions. And we talked to enough doctors at the time, psychiatrists, and it stands to reason if somebody's encouraging this, saying this is really okay, the chances are it's going to get worse. And that's exactly what happened with him. So I think it's an extension that just swerved way beyond where it really had to be.
Yeah, it's unfortunate because you talked earlier about sort of escaping his father's shadow, but he seems to have also in the process sort of escaped every normal human bond that ordinary people would share with each other. Do you think that sort of that desire to overachieve relative to his father was like the primary drive in his life?
Yes, we do. I mean, he idolized his father. His father was a classic self-made man. Howard wasn't. Howard inherited a very lucrative business, the Hughes Tool Company, that revolutionized the oil industry and every year turned out enormous profits. And these financed all of Howard's other ventures. So there's no doubt he looked in awe at his father, what his father had done to come up with this drill, to patent it, to then market it, to show it to the world as this astonishing invention. So I don't think there's any doubt about it. He was constantly in his mind, in his father's shadow. Though you can argue that on aviation alone, he certainly surpassed his father's accomplishments. But in his mind, it was our opinion, we never felt that he really did. So I think that was... And it's also possibly one of those things that happens when your parents die when you're young and you're not able to work out a lot of things that maybe you need to work out when you're a teenager or younger. All of that stuff was just there, and he was suddenly alone at age 18.
Yeah, that part of the reason why I ask about the relationship with his father was because as I was sort of going back over the Howard Hughes story, he has so many similarities to our current president in a lot of ways. The fact that his father was very much a self-made man,
mm-hmm.
feels in, as though he is living in his father's shadow, constantly trying to outdo him. And Trump even at one point said, this is before he got into politics, that he could see himself at the end of his life becoming a sort of Howard Hughes-type recluse. And that those are his words. Obviously, the opposite has happened. But the sort of transition point I kind of want to make here to the new version of America, What Went Wrong, that you put out recently, called America, What Went Wrong, The Crisis Deepens. It's kind of an ominous title, I think, especially in these times. Why did you feel the need to put out a new edition of this book?
A couple different reasons. One, we continued to observe how many of the things that we had pinpointed back in the early 90s as trouble spots ahead for the American economy, starting with income inequality. We began observing that all of these things were getting worse. And we also thought it was very important for, frankly, a younger generation, and actually a couple of generations since the original book was published, to see how embedded a lot of these problems are in the American system. And we think that because people might realize they're not new, it might provide a greater sense of urgency to try to do something about them. So the book actually stayed in print for many, many years. It only dropped out of print by 4 or 5 years ago. And rather than just bring it back as it was, with maybe a new introduction, we decided to not only write new prologue and epilogue, introduction and sort of conclusion, but to take each chapter and take each of the major points and see what had happened with them. And that's what's very shocking about the new book, because at least that's what people have told us. They knew things were bad. They knew income inequality had worsened. But they didn't frankly realize that we had frankly warned about this long ago and said, if we don't change this, this is going to get a lot worse. Turned out back in the 90s, that was very controversial. The Wall Street Journal attacked us in a lead editorial back in 1992, called us the sister soldiers of economic populism.
Really?
Yeah. Isn't that a great one?
For people who don't know, Sister Soldier was a woman who made very, what were considered extreme racial remarks.
And yes. You knew exactly where she stood on and everything. So the idea was we were screaming at people. I guess that's what they were saying. But anyway, and other people criticized. They said, look, this is a recession back in the 90s. We're going to get through this. Things are going to be okay again. The middle class is not shrinking. Well, and we show in the updated book that the middle class has shrunk some more. And now, you know, less than one out of three taxpayers are in the middle class to this day. You go back a few decades and that situation is markedly different. So part of it is to bring more recent Americans up to date on this, but it's also to remind people, even of my generation and slightly younger, that we have failed as Americans to confront issues of income inequality, job creation, health care. All of those things have worsened. And that's why we say the crisis deepens. And it's in our book, a graver crisis than it was back in the 90s for that reason.
So I had read recently Hunter Thompson's book about the 72 campaign. In it, he's talking about income inequality. And Gore Vidal, in his famous debate with William F. Buckley, is talking about income inequality back in 68. So is this something that has just always existed in America and it's just gotten significantly worse, or do you identify a beginning of this crisis?
Well, people have written, we've always had certainly the rich and the middle class and the poor in this country, and that always will be. Nobody is making remarks about somebody who's succeeded and well in business and so forth. That's not the point. It's ironic that Vidal would have been talking about this in the 60s, because it really wasn't until the late 70s that incomes really began to diverge in this country. If you go from the end of World War II really into the mid-70s, and you sort of track the percentage increase of folks at the top versus the middle class, It's very, very similar. But since really roughly the late 70s or early 80s on, those lines have diverged. And one of the statistics we have in the book is on CEO pay. Peter Drucker, the great guru of business economics and essays, years ago came up with a figure. He said the ratio of a CEO's salary to the person on the factory floor or the department store floor, whatever entity it is, should be roughly 20 to 1. For every dollar that person, that worker made, the CEO should make 20 times that. Well, when we wrote the original edition of America, What Went Wrong, people were shocked to find out by then it was now then 90 to 1. And people just gasped at the time. Well, today it's more than 300 to 1. So income inequality, while always an aspect in many ways part of the U.S., is just vastly more severe now than it was in, let's say, 1979, 1980. The reason in our book, from the end of World War II through the 70s, was the tax code was fair. The rich paid a higher percentage of taxes. Corporations paid a higher percentage of the total income taxes than they do today. All of those things struck a kind of balance in the American system. And that balance today is gone. So while we've always had variations in income and wealth, it's just so much, much, much greater today than it's really been since perhaps the late 19th century.
Let me ask you, when you talk about the tax code, obviously people like AOC have put out ideas that we could tax income over $10 million at 70%. Is something like that a proposal you might agree with, or what are you talking about exactly with the tax code?
I wouldn't have any problem with that. I don't think that's ever going to happen again in terms of that high a percentage. But I'm saying to make the right now the highest rate is 37% on the, at the federal level. As recently as 1980, I guess that's not that recent now, but in 1980, the top rate on some income was 70%. So here you have our total top rate today, 37%. What we call for in the new book is tax capital gains as ordinary income. In other words, the same that you would pay if you were working a salary, working a job. That's something many students of the tax system have long felt would be fair. I don't know if it has to be 70% on the top incomes, but it should be increased for folks certainly making more than $1 million by a few decimal points, and those making $5 or $10 million by considerably more than that. And also corporations. I mean, what's happened with corporations is just people don't realize this. That's why so many of these things are happening. That's why the tax code, taxes, are the great driver of inequality, because corporations used to pay roughly 40% of the total amount of income taxes paid in the U.S. That was corporate and individual. This year, even before COVID-19, the corporate percentage was under 10%. Individuals make up the rest. So, you know, corporations derive many benefits by being in the United States. But they no longer pay their way the way they once did. So there's a whole range of things, from certain kinds of write-offs they have to simply raising individual rates. It's a long list. We get into some of them in the book. But it's our belief that the tax code has been the single greatest driver of income inequality. There are other issues from training and trade and deregulation, but in our book, it's the one that's consistently been at the root of the problem.
About the tax code, because the argument before the recent tax cuts in 2018 that the corporate tax rate in America was among, if not the highest in the world, but the effective tax rate, meaning like the rate at which they actually paid, was lower. So are you saying that these loopholes that were written into the tax code were effectively written in there on purpose to allow corporations to avoid paying certain taxes?
Absolutely. And there are numerous ones, and talk about one in the 2000 in the Trump tax bill that you just mentioned. But here's a perfect example. Interest on corporate debt. If you borrow money to run your business or build a plant, you can charge off the interest for that construction and so forth. But if you borrow that money and just send it right out to stockholders as an additional dividend or something like that, or pay yourself, the CEO, four times what you were making last year, that's fine too. You borrowed the money, and guess what? You can write off the interest on your tax code. The interest on corporate debt is skyrocketing. There's $10 trillion in corporate debt before COVID-19. Not sure exactly what that number is right now, but it's certainly no lower than that. It's probably considerably higher. That's an all-time record, all-time high. And the interest on that debt gets written off every year, hundreds of millions of dollars. So, and that has been a tremendous vehicle for the private equity companies who function largely on borrowed money. They borrowed money to take over a company, take it apart, send maybe half the workforce packing, and courtesy of taxpayers, write off a lot of the expenses for creating that mayhem. I mean, that's the kind of thing that should be significantly scaled back, if not eliminated. The Trump tax bill actually made a nick in that particular deduction. But it was totally offset by the overall rate reduction from 35% to 21%. So there's all kinds of ways, if we as a nation have the will to go about this. It could be an increase in the corporate tax rate. It could be the elimination of certain deductions, like the one I just mentioned, that have been counterproductive for the livelihood of a lot of average Americans. It could be a whole range of other things. So it just has... But we have to have the will, we have to have the desire, and we have to put in place a plan that would not be repealed the next year. We have to take the long term if we're really going to rebuild the middle class and get out of this crisis.
Well, let me ask you something, though, because as you're talking about this, of how this plays politically, because slogans like, you know, eat the rich, which I'm sure you've heard before, and sort of quote-unquote class warfare, which is kind of a silly term, but those sorts of appeals strike people's gut and can get people motivated. But once you start talking about, oh, well, we have to change corporate tax code and income earners over 5 and 10 million, you know, a few decimal points, I agree that these would be solutions, but do you think part of the lack of political will is because those almost technocratic tweaks don't seem as sexy politically?
I think that's absolutely the case. And I also think, unlike some other issues in the society, taxes are beyond the comprehension of a lot of people, when in fact they're not really that complicated. That's the thing I've learned over the years. The vast bulk of people don't even do their own taxes. In fact, the vast bulk of people now don't even itemize taxes. It's other things that they do. But taxes seem complicated, and that opens the door for all kinds of things to happen in the tax legislation. And let me just give an example from the Trump tax bill there in 2017. Trump made a big comment. He said, no rich person is going to benefit at all from this bill. It's just not going to happen. Well, the numbers are just indisputable. And the Joint Committee on Taxation is a widely respected congressional body that's been around for 100 years or more. They put together a report after the bill passed. And what did it show? It showed everybody in the class of taxpayers earning $1 million or more would receive on average a tax cut of in excess of $64,000 a year for 10 years. Let's say you're in the heart of the middle class making $50,000 to $75,000. You received, as a in that class, an average tax cut of roughly $800 a year. So what happens with that is that somebody gets a little tax cut and they think, wow, look at this. This is great. And they're totally ignorant of the benefits further up the line that are much more serious and in fact, outrageous. We calculated, and I didn't see anybody else do this, that folks earning more than $1 million a year, you know, that class of people, more than $500 trillion in tax cuts will flow to them over the life of that tax bill. $500 trillion. I mean, think of all the things that you could do with that money in the United States to invest it in the country as a whole. But a lot of people don't get that. They don't understand that's the way this worked. And it's not a mystery. It's right there to be extrapolated very easily from the Joint Committee report. It's I didn't bend the ear of some congressional aide and let him whisper in my ear, well, how much did this mean to the risk? It's right there in black and white. It's no mystery. And that's the thing about taxes. Most of the stuff isn't mysterious. It's there. It's just a matter of putting it together. And that's really what we've tried to do in this book.
Let me ask you this, because when you're saying, oh, we didn't have to bend the ear of some congressional aide or anything like that, and you do go into very clear, in-depth analysis, but I wanted to get your take on this because you have been in journalism for decades. You've won Pulitzer Prize, you've won George Polk Awards. You're as accomplished as anybody in your field. And it seems like the state of journalism today is, I don't want to say it's dying, but certainly newsrooms are downsizing, if not closing.
Yes. Yes.
There's a lot of clickbait articles. And that sort of in-depth analysis is kind of falling to the wayside. Coming from the inside, are you worried about the future of journalism?
I'm worried, and I can't tell you how this will work itself out, but I think as long as we've been a nation, there have been journalists, and there have been varying ways that they've figured out ways to get the story out. Think of Tom Paine and Paine and Common Sense at the time of the American Revolution, the little pamphlet that sweeps the country. Wouldn't he have had fun in this day and age of social media? So I'm not sure what this landscape is going to look like 10, 15, 20 years from now. But I think here's what's happening, and it's not totally dark. There's a lot of investigative reporting going on, but what I'm worried about are what I would call the city hall beat, the courthouse beat, the state capitol beat, all of those places where reporters used to cover things, where the trick was to make friends with the assistant director of public works in city hall. And it was something really scurrilous happened, he would whisper in your ear about something and tell you that, and then you could go after or have somebody else go after it. If you eliminate those beats, it means you don't get that content. You still may have some investigative reporting, but you're probably going to miss some of these other ones. So I'm quite worried about it from the standpoint of local reporting as much as anything else. The sophistication of a lot of young journalists today is absolutely breathtaking. When I broke into journalism, journalists paid no attention to numbers. They thought numbers were something for the nerd who sat in the back room of the algebra class or something like that. I mean, nobody really thought about them much at all. And there's been a revolution in journalism during the time I've been in journalism, where reporters now realize that numbers are very, very important, not to the exclusion of interviews, not to the exclusion of human stories, but they're very important to show exactly how our institutions are working or not working. And it takes the story out of the realm of anecdote. You show systematically this is what's going on. That's why one of the reasons America What Went Wrong was such a sensation originally was that it combined the human stories with that data and showed what was happening to a lot of these people middle-class people losing their jobs, losing their benefits. It showed that what was happening to them was not just an exception, but part of a broader pattern and coming about because of actual national actions that had were impacting them, that were eroding their way of life. So to answer your question, I am very worried about what I'm seeing, especially with a lot of local newspapers. There isn't one of them that's the size that it used to be, which means not only do they not cover domestic stories, they don't have foreign stories either. I think I grew up in Kansas City, and I suspect the average reader of the Kansas City Star in the 50s knew more national, international city do today, partly because the Star is a shadow of its old self. And we all know most local television stations aren't doing much with news. And even the networks don't have a lot of foreign news. So we're in this odd situation where technically there's more information than ever, but I'm not so sure in reality it's available to most people.
It is an odd situation. And it seems, when you mentioned, it seems harder than ever to break through with new ideas when you have mediums like Twitter that, by definition, limit thought into 140 or 280
yes. characters. Well, I think this is one of the real concerns a lot of journalists have had, because many of the things Don and I've done over the years are lengthy, to put it mildly. The Hughes book, for example, is a very long book. And a lot of the journalism we did for newspapers and magazines was quite long. People are told over and over again now that, well, people won't read long things. I don't think that's true if it's done right, but it is also true that a lot of the way information is presented now is in such a, it's not truncated form, but certainly shrunken form, I guess would be the term, that there just isn't the opportunity to have that much raw information that would help people understand the issue. So I worry about that a lot, and I don't know how it's going to work out. I know there's a lot of wonderful people in journalism, young people. I just hope there's going to be the business model for all of them.
How do you feel in particular about the Trump era of journalism? Because there was a lot of critique running up to the election that media gave him a lot of free airtime, was uncritical in the beginning, and then they did kind of a 180 and became very critical to the point where I think some people, it makes it easier for Trump to sort of say the media is out to get me.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on that?
I think your assessment on the early period in his campaign and run for president, I think that's absolutely right. There was the traditional approach that here's somebody out there, and there were stories written, by the way, and David K. Johnson is an old friend of mine who from Philadelphia Inquirer days and wrote some pretty damning stories at the time, and then later books about Trump, partly because he actually covered Trump when Trump was running one of his Atlantic City casinos in the ground. So he knew the territory. But I think a lot of journalists didn't. They approached it almost the traditional way, give everybody their say, so forth. That's true. But on the other hand, what is feeding the disinformation? It's not, I don't think, the traditional media. I think it's a lot of these wacky sites that are coming up with these conspiracy theories that are just astonishing. And of course, it goes all the way to the top. I mean, look at Michael Caputo. I mean, just Health and Human Services, who just took his medical leave apparently yesterday. I mean, based on everything he's done the last week, I think it looks like he should have taken that leave about 2 years ago, maybe. I mean, you've got people holding office and saying things now that are just inconceivable in the past. And how these people are in power, how they got into power, how enough people were persuaded to vote for them, remains something of a mystery to me. I know what part of the story is. I mean, the two parties in this country, you're going to have some people vote Republican. I don't care if Donald Duck is running. I mean, that's just where they are, and that's what they'll always do. And whoever the nominee is, they'll do that. So I understand that on both sides, both left and right. But some of the things Trump has done have been so outrageous and so full of lies, you would think that alone would turn an awful lot of people off. I mean, just the tax thing I mentioned. The comment, no rich person is going to benefit from this tax bill. Well, those are the folks who benefited from that bill. But it's been one lie after another like that. And why that doesn't disturb more people remains a mystery to me.
Well, I had talked to Reed Hunt, who wrote a book about his time as part of the Obama transition team. And when we're talking here about inequality, he blamed in large part the bank bailouts and the fact that more was not done for the middle class in the aftermath of the 2008 financial collapse, which he portrayed, and I probably agree with, was a massive financial scandal that sunk the economy. And when you have someone running on a platform of hope and change, and then the people who caused this crisis turn out richer than before it happened, that can make people lose hope in democracy and be willing to accept a strong man. Do you think that analysis holds water?
I think that's, and more people than me certainly have done the parallel with Hitler. I mean, the similarity is quite eerie. I'm not saying Trump is Hitler, but I'm saying in terms of the way strong figures emerge in various countries based on the disarray of the populace, and they're looking for somebody who gives them a simple answer about what they're going to do. And it's just like Trump the other night on the town meeting in Philadelphia, proceeded to answer very few of those questions that were put to him, that he had just his canned responses that totally ignored the questions. So that's what people who want to craft and create public opinion and bolster it do. And he's very, very good at that. So I think, and Trump does project a very strong figure. And I'm sure that has an appeal with X number of people. Especially if they don't look a little deeper as to exactly what he's advocating and what he stands for.
Right. Yes, exactly. And as we sort of wrap up here, I wanted to get your take on Bill Clinton. Sort of spoke around at rallies and said that it had deeply influenced. Now, obviously, fast forward, I think, been maybe like 30 years since the book came out, and now you're putting out a new edition of The Crisis Has Deepened. So clearly, even if you have politicians at the highest level saying, hey, I agree with your thesis, and this has influenced me and it's influenced my politics, but the crisis was not solved. When you saw that happening, how did you feel about it? How do you feel about it now? Did it give you hope, disheartening?
You mean in terms of the Clinton years and after the book was published? Two things happened. On taxes, I've never forgotten this. When Clinton did come in, he shepherded a tax bill through that did raise the rates on the wealthy. Not a lot, but it did raise them, which at that time appeared to be revolutionary. And conservatives all said at the time that this was going to absolutely destroy the economy and water down initiative, blah, blah, blah. Well, of course, the opposite happened. There were years after that of significant growth. And it gets to the heart of one of my points, but taxes are sometimes overdone in terms of exaggerated or influenced one way or another when it's something that small, especially tax increases, if they benefit the country as a whole. But I think what happened with Clinton, he made a real mistake on health care. And I'm just speaking my personal opinion on this. He never should have put Hillary in charge of that panel. She's very competent. She knows the issues backwards and forwards. But when you have a blue ribbon panel on an issue of that importance in the country, you want to be able to deal with it on an arm's length basis. So you want people other than your wife or your husband or even your brother on that particular panel, so that whatever its recommendations are, it doesn't look like you have some connection to them. I mean, that fueled a lot of the opposition to Bill right out of the box, which then led to him losing the majority in Congress. And once that happened, then there are all kinds of things he's not going to get done. He did do a few things, and he was even able to balance the budget a little bit toward the end of the 90s, which was kind of a miracle. The first, those 3 years were the first time it had been balanced in, I don't have it right in front of me now, but more than 30 years, I think. And it hasn't been balanced since then, of course. I'm sorry, not balanced, but no deficit spending. Anyway, but once he lost that majority in the Congress, I mean, he's doomed. He's not at that point significantly going to change a lot of these economic issues. He may thrive in foreign affairs. He may be able to do some executive orders, creating new national parks. He may be able to do a lot of those things, and I'm not minimizing those, that's all important. But in terms of getting to the bone of the problem, taxes, deregulation, putting money into the economy, you got to have Congress working with you on that. And he lost it in 2 years and never got it back. So I think he would have done more things if he'd actually had the team that he could have worked with.
So the last question I wanted to ask you then is, obviously we have an election coming up, and even beyond that, these issues are going to stay with us for some time, most likely. What would you tell people listening to this podcast right now? How is there any way that, besides just pressing a lever or pulling a lever in November for one of the two candidates, is there anything that ordinary people can do to perhaps influence these issues?
I think people need to find out, you know, what groups there are in their area that deal with issues that are of concern to them. Let's just say it's healthcare. Use that as a device to make your voice heard. Taxes are more amorphous. There's not a, I don't think you're going to find a committee to increase my taxes anywhere. It just doesn't exist, of course. But obviously, to let the lawmakers know how you feel on those things. But in areas like healthcare, certainly pensions, there are a lot of groups out there that are organizing or have organized that want to make their voice heard. I think along with taxes, healthcare has loomed even before COVID-19 as the big issue out there right now. I mean, even before COVID, we had roughly 10, 15, 20 million people still without health insurance. And now, of course, it's much, much worse because people have lost their coverage as they were furloughed by their companies. And this has exposed another kind of Achilles heel of the American healthcare system. If we had some kind of a platform, a foundation like Social Security for everybody, if something happened to you, going to the hospital, getting sued. And hospitals in this country, even you can't pay, they sue you. They even sue some of their own employees sometimes, believe it or not. if the copay isn't covered by that employee. So healthcare, I think, is going to be a big issue. I think trying to find those organizations in their area that are interested in that, same thing for retirement. Those are the big ones. If they don't see it in their local area, people should reach out to the national groups and find out if they're aware of anything regionally that might be at hand. I think organizations are looking for support. They're looking for volunteers. They want to hear from people. The American system still depends on what we as individuals do at the ballot box and elsewhere. And it's old-fashioned to talk about voting, but I don't think it's ever been truer than now at both the presidency and the Congress. If enough people vote and if enough people change things, then things can get done. If they don't, things won't get done. So it's pretty simple and pretty clear. So it's be very interesting to see exactly what happens. There's been so much discussion on the crisis of the mail-in ballots and how this is going to work itself out. It devolves down to about five or six states, which are going to, once again, going to be pivotal this whole election. And how well they handle that issue is going to be crucial to finding out where we are. So, but where I've talked to people, virtually, I might add, this time for this book, people do want to do things. They love their country. They want to do the kinds of things that advance the country as a whole. And I think that's the best of America. And hopefully, after this election, we can start doing some of that.
Well, I think on that note, it's a good note to end it on. James, thank you very much for your time. Is there anything you want to plug before we go?
No, Duncan. I just I appreciate if anybody wants more information about the books. They can just look at our website, barletandsteel.com, or look up my name, James B. Steele, and books, and we'll get the same kind of thing. But other than that, and it also shows everything, not just the books, but the journalism background and where we stand on a lot of pivotal issues. But I really enjoyed talking to you today, and great questions on your part.
My pleasure.
Thank you to James Steele, and thanks for listening to Dunk Tank. I'm Duncan Gammy. See you next time.